Of the Lasers and Electro-Optics Society, the IEEE Ottawa chapter. My name's John Bernard, and I'm the current chairman of the Ottawa section. Today, our speaker is Kevin Lear from Sandia National Laboratory in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Dr. Lear has been at Sandia since 1990, and before that, he was at the University of Colorado, where he received his Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering. And then he went on to Stanford University, where he received his master's and PhD degrees. His primary research area at Sandia has been compound semiconductor optoelectronics, with an emphasis on enhancing the performance of vertical cavity surface emitting lasers, or VCSELs. This has included work on integrating transistors and VCSELs for smart pixels, coherent laser arrays, VCSEL-based optical interconnects, mirror grating designs and fabrication for improved electrical characteristics, the use of oxides for improved optical characteristics, and most recently, investigating the high-speed operation of VCSELs. Dr. Lear is a current distinguished speaker for the Lasers and Electro-Optics Society, and today the title of this talk will be High Efficiency Vertical Cavity Surface Emitting Lasers. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, John, for that introduction. I want to thank John also for making the arrangements for my trip today and allowing me to visit NRC while I'm here. What I want to talk to you about today is work that has been going on at Sandia National Labs over about the past 5 years, where we've been working on improving the performance of vertical cavity surface emitting lasers. In particular, we have been trying to improve the efficiency of these devices, and I want to tell you how we've gone about doing that and some of the associated advances. First, before I dig into the technical details, however, I want to acknowledge a lot of people that you see here at Sandia National Laboratories that have assisted in various aspects of this work, as well as these other folks from other organizations that you see who have contributed some of the slides that I'll use today. So here's the game plan for today. I want to, first of all, give a brief introduction to vertical cavity surface emitting lasers, and so all you VCSEL experts out there can fall asleep for about 5 minutes while I go through that. Then I want to talk about two aspects of the problem that are related to making more efficient devices, namely electrical loss and optical loss. As a result of those advances, not only have we been able to realize much more efficient devices, but there have been other benefits as well, and I'll talk about that in this related advances section. And finally, just want to give you a glimpse at some of the things that are going on in the commercial world and talking about the applications and showing you some examples of those. So I'll try to keep the amount of jargon down this talk, but there's, afraid, one acronym that I can't deal without, which is this one, Vertical Cavity Surface Emitting Laser, which is pronounced VCSEL. It's important to notice that the emphasis is on VIC. The emphasis is not on cell, despite the fact that we've been accused of that in the past. I figured you all knew that, but I thought I would make sure I got my joke in anyway. So this is the type of device that we're talking about. It's a light-emitting laser diode. The light comes out of this aperture in the top, with the aperture being defined in a metallic contact that is used to drive current into the epitaxial layers that are grown on top of the gallium arsenide substrate. Now, in understanding this device, I'd like to compare it with the more conventional type of edge-emitting laser diode that you see in the diagram on the right-hand side here, and talk about a little bit of the differences between these two types of laser diodes. Edge-emitting laser diodes, like VCSELs, are defined by lithography on a wafer of epitaxial material. However, after they're defined, they need to be broken into these sections so that you can gain access to the facets. The facets not only act as facets act as mirror to reflect the light in the cavity that is oscillating in the horizontal direction. And you need to break it apart in order to form these facets, as well as to do things such as facet coating on the devices. In contrast, the VCSEL devices can operate as grown after lithography without breaking the wafer into pieces. This allows us to test the devices on wafer and determine which ones work before the wafer is broken apart and can't be handled as a whole anymore. Also, as you can see from this diagram, that we can make two-dimensional arrays quite readily from this type of technology by placing the lasers side by side, whereas in the edge-emitting devices, the geometry really only allows one-dimensional arrays. One final note about these devices is that if you think about it, the transverse dimensions are defined in different ways. For the surface-emitting laser, we're defining the geometry the same in both transverse dimensions. That means in the dimensions orthogonal to the beam propagation. We're using lithography, and so that we can make devices that look relatively symmetric and emit symmetric beams. However, for the edge-emitting lasers, we are defining the devices in the lateral direction with lithography, but defining them in the vertical direction with epitaxy. And as a result, the beam profile in the waveguide is somewhat elliptical, and this also leads to an elliptical pattern in the far field. And to illustrate this, I want to show you a pretty picture of a couple of laser diode beams that come from devices, both of which have been made at Sandia National Laboratories. They both emit at 670 nanometers. On the left-hand side, for reference, is an edge-emitting laser diode, and you can't quite see it, but the bar is there on the edge of the heat sink, and the shiny thing is a probe coming down. Maybe you can see the little spot of light where the laser diode is. You can certainly see the elliptic beam projected on the quadrangle paper, showing you what the far field looks like. In contrast, on the right-hand side, we see a nice round circular spot coming out of a VCSEL on the chip. You can see the laser diode on the chip lit up, where there are also many others that are not operating. And this gives you an indication of the low divergence angle of the VCSEL, which is comparable to the narrow divergence angle of the edge emitter. This type of nice circular low divergence beam profile is one of the advantages of the VCSEL. Let me just quickly run through my advertisement for VCSELs here to tell you about what the others are. The devices have surface normal output, which means the beams move away from the substrate, and this actually simplifies packaging by allowing us to, for example, glue the devices down on a heat sink with less precision than is necessary to align, say, an output facet to the edge of a conventional copper heat sink when the beam is in plane. Also, the beam qualities that I mentioned allow us to simplify the optics design so that we don't have to correct for astigmatism, and this reduces the cost of optic systems. Also, keeping in mind that the device is defined in the vertical direction using epitaxy, we are able to make a relatively short cavity length device, and this makes the device operate in a single longitudinal mode. Just a couple of other things is the small active volume also gives us low threshold operation and allows us, much like DFB lasers, to have thermally stable operation by offsetting the gain and resonance peak. The small active dimensions as well as a low threshold current contribute to high speed operation. I'll talk about that in greater detail later on, and of course it will also let us make one- and two-dimensional arrays like the two-dimensional array you see in the photograph here. Now, while all those performance advantages are very appealing to us, especially as researchers, what really has people excited about making these things are the manufacturing advantages listed on the bottom. Again, one of the key ones here is that the fact that you can test the devices on wafer and evaluate them before you incur the packaging expense. Secondly, you can more readily integrate the devices with one another, as well as potentially with electronics, and also integrate them into optical systems using the surface normal beam. Finally, we're really doing something here that resembles fairly closely standard microelectronics fabrication once the epitaxy is grown. And so we can produce these things in bulk, in tens of thousands per wafer, and leverage all the investment that's been made in microelectronic processing. So for all those wonderful advantages, there are also challenges that are associated with the geometry of VCSELs, and this slide is used to indicate that. A typical edge-emitting laser is relatively long, say hundreds of microns, maybe up to 1 millimeter long. And as the light is amplified along this long region, we get a fair amount of gain, and we can let a large fraction of the light out as it encounters this facet that is formed from cleaving the interface. So that even if there is little as the 30% reflectivity at the semiconductor air interface, we can still maintain a round-trip gain condition. For the VCSEL, on the other hand, as a general rule of thumb, the round-trip gain is limited to about 1%. And because of that, we need very highly reflecting mirrors. Say for the useful output, the output coupler side, we need reflectivities of about 99% or higher. And for the high reflector side, we want even higher reflectivities, maybe 99.9% or greater. Even with these high reflectivities, Typically, we have to drive VCSEL material a little harder than edge emitter materials in order to make it work in a useful range. So you can see that in these particular numbers I've chosen here, maybe we have a threshold current density of 400 amps per centimeter squared for the VCSEL, where the threshold current density for the edge emitter is 100 amps per centimeter squared. And this is to get the higher material gain, as I show. Nonetheless, even with this higher threshold current density, when you factor in the size of the devices, the threshold currents for the VCSEL can be quite small. You can see the numbers here calculate to something on the order of a milliamp, and I'll show you examples later on of much lower threshold currents, whereas typical threshold currents for the edge emitters are on the order of 10 milliamps. So one of the keys to making these devices work in this fashion is the epitaxial structure, and this is an example of the epitaxial structure. It shows the growth of an aluminum gallium arsenide mirror going from about 10% aluminum gallium arsenide to 90% aluminum gallium arsenide. Okay. Tell you what, we can stop. The geometric perspective, the mirror is really a major part of the VCSEL structure, with the one wavelength cavity being a relatively small fraction of the total epitaxial thickness. And this just happens to show the details for this device designed to operate at 980 nanometers that uses three indium gallium arsenide quantum wells in a graded aluminum gallium arsenide fashion. So this is what the epitaxy that's stacked up on top of the wafer looks like. And as my last introduction to VCSEL slide here, I'll tell you what we have to do laterally with this structure. Basically, we want to pixelate this somehow, break it into separate little pieces so that we can make lasers that are side by side. And this shows three schemes that have been used in order to fabricate the devices. On the far right-hand side here, we see an etched air post sample. This was really the first thing that was done, was to take this material and etch away the region on the outside and put an opaque metal contact all over the top. The etching did two things. It confines the current flow into an isolated active region, but it also provides wave guiding in that there's an index contrast between the air and the semiconductor that confines the optical beam. Now, of course, the drawback of this type of opaque contact structure up here is that the light can't go through it, so this type of device really works best at wavelengths where the light can come down through the substrate, say for a gallium arsenide substrate, at wavelengths beyond about 870 nanometers. Well, the solution to that is demonstrated here, and this was initially done by Yang Li and colleagues at Bell Laboratories in about 1990. They cut a hole in the contact to let the light out, but then in order to keep the current from just going straight down underneath the contact region, they damaged the semiconductor by implanting protons at high energies in order to create point defects that compensate the material and render it insulating. As a result of the insulating character, the current can flow into the middle of the device and recombine here, and the light can come back out the top surface. Now, that was a really big advance in terms of making these devices manufacturable and useful and easy to test with this top emission, and allowing them to operate at wavelengths that were shorter than the absorption edge of the substrate. But there are actually some problems with this structure. Namely, this implant alters the electrical properties, but it's not providing any index guiding the way this etch did over here. And so we're missing the confinement of the optical confinement we need for the device. And it's actually this final structure here on the right that addresses that issue. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. We'll come back to this later on. But now by converting a portion of these epitaxial layers from an aluminum gallium arsenide to an aluminum oxide that's not only insulating but also low index, we're able to confine the light into a small interior active region so that we're not only funneling the current in here, but we're confining the light, and that ends up giving us much better lasers. And we'll talk about the benefits of this oxide confinement later on. But let me back up and talk first about just some of the general notions associated with why we're considering power conversion efficiency. If you think about laser diodes, there's a whole host of parameters that you might analyze. You might think about threshold current, slope efficiency, voltage. And the reason for thinking about power conversion efficiency in some sense is because it really involves all of these. How much of the total input electrical power is getting turned into optical power? This has some systems implications in terms of, for example, how big a power supply you need in order to drive a bunch of these lasers. However, that's really not a major situation once you start making even reasonably efficient devices. As you can see from the green line here, as we make more and more power conversion efficient devices, the amount of input power kind of saturates asymptotically approaching, of course, the amount of output power we want. But what is interesting is that as we continue to make more and more efficient devices, we continue to gain exponentially in terms of the amount of heat dissipation of the device. And heat is a real problem for these VCSELs. It decreases the gain of the device, giving you lower output powers and increasing threshold, but even more importantly, it elevates the junction temperature and exponentially activates degradation processes in the devices. So if we want to make long-lived, reliable devices and ones that operate at higher ambient temperature, we really need to get rid of the extra heat generation. Now, maybe a less academic and more practical sense, the other reason why power conversion efficiency is a good thing to talk about in these devices is this power conversion efficiency really sums up the major things that were wrong with these devices about 5 years ago. This shows a plot of devices made at Sandia National Laboratories in about 1991 and in about 1993 to 94 time frame. And you can see the output power in the red curve and the voltage in the green curves. As you can see, the old device had a much higher operating voltage, and it also produced much less power and had a higher threshold current. And the other parameters of these lasers are very comparable. So in making devices, moving from this dashed curve to the solid curve where we've reduced the voltage drop or the input power, as well as increasing the output power, we've really greatly improved the efficiency of the devices. Okay. How do we go about doing that? Well, the reason the devices are inefficient is because they have losses. And there's really two categories of loss I want to talk to you about today. One is electrical loss, and the other is optical loss. These mirrors that we're stacking up have to serve really more purposes than just the optical purpose. They have three functions. The optical one, in order to reflect light, but they also have to provide a current path in our monolithic semiconductor structure so that we're injecting current through the mirrors to the active region. And finally, they have to carry that heat back out from the active region that we're generating in the interior of it. Now, unfortunately, if we take the simplest approach and just juxtapose these high and low index materials that have associated with them high and low band gap energies, then we end up with big potentials at these interfaces that can be schematically represented by these resistors. So when we try to drive current through our laser diode, we actually drop a relatively large voltage, and this is the source of the associated electrical loss. So that's one problem we have to deal with. On the other side of things, we have an optical loss. Again, we have very highly reflective mirrors, but we have them in a plane cavity geometry. And so over the course of a photon lifetime, on average, before this photon has a chance to escape, it passes many times between these mirrors, and in the course of that has some chance to walk off sideways. Now, these implants, as I said before, confine the current, but they don't do a good job confining the light. And as a result, if the light is diffracting outwards and encountering these unpumped gain regions, then we encounter a substantial amount of loss. This is particularly crucial for VCSELs because we're dealing with devices that only have a 1% round-trip gain again, and so we can only tolerate very small additional losses in the structure. And as a result, we need to find some way to confine the light in and get rid of this optical loss, and we'll come to that part a little later on. So, let's go ahead and talk about mirror stack design. And especially to those of you in the back row, this may appear to be an eye test chart, but all you really have to see is some of the general trends where we're plotting appropriate properties versus aluminum mole fraction in these graphs. Again, there's this optical, electrical, and thermal properties of the mirrors that we care about. And if you were going to design a mirror stack to do just any one of those jobs, you'd come up with very different answers. For optical reflectivity, or to confine the photons, you would vary the aluminum mole fraction as much as possible because refractive index changes monotonically in aluminum mole fraction. And you'd do it as abruptly as possible. For electrical processes, you'd really prefer a mirror that's made out of pure gallium arsenide because, one, it has the highest mobility as a function of aluminum mole fraction, and two, by not changing the band gap, we don't get any barriers in there. For the thermal processes, you'd really prefer a mirror that's pure aluminum arsenide, or is not a bad second choice, pure gallium arsenide, because the thermal resistivity of pure aluminum arsenide is 8 times lower than the range aluminum gallium arsenide compositions, and gallium arsenide is pretty close to it. So we have three very disparate requirements for our mirror. Fortunately, all of these mechanisms are happening on different length scales that we can combine all of the properties and make a good mirror in all three cases. for the photons, they're really interacting with the fundamental period of this grating. So as long as we keep the fundamental period large, we can do things such as grate out the interfaces slightly without substantially reducing that fundamental component. For the electrons and holes, they're able to screen out potentials on the order of a Debye length in the material. And so if we dope it appropriately, we can, and don't make these transitions any more abrupt than about the Debye length, we can screen out those potentials. And lastly, for the thermal transport properties, if you could read the numbers on these dots here, you'd see that if you make a 50 angstrom period superlattice, it has a thermal resistivity that's comparable to just what the pure alloy is. But if you make a superlattice that has a period of 200 or 300 angstroms, you have something that has a thermal resistivity much lower, closer to the interpolated value between the two endpoints. And so in a standard type of distributed Bragg reflector, we actually end up with thermal resistivities that are much lower. Okay. The primary concern then in these mirrors had been the electrical properties of them, especially trying to transport current vertically through the mirror stack. And people had addressed that in a variety of grating schemes. And this is kind of a catalog of grating schemes that have been used. This, let me just quickly tell you how to read these graphs before I dive into this. There's a green solid line that can be read on either axis, either on the right-hand axis, refraction, say here going from 10% to 90%, or on the left-hand axis is the equivalent valence band minimum hole energy. So these band diagrams are inverted from the conventional sense in that we're plotting hole energy here. Now, if we take that valence band, which is the potential that would exist if we're undoped, and we dope the sample, say at 2 times 10 to the 18, we produce carrier distributions in here that can rearrange and screen out some of this potential, and we get the curve that's shown in the dotted red line here as actually the potential in the valence band. Well, if you're trying to transport holes through this structure that have a relatively low tunneling probability, and they have to surmount a barrier that's 10 times the thermal energy KT, with thermionic emission, you're going to have relatively high resistance. So people just started looking at ways to break this barrier into pieces and reduce that energy, or even do linear grades and reduce it further. You can see that basically the trend here is to make the transition smoother and smoother through parabolic gratings. You can even do things like space charge doping to reduce it. Now, these are two designs that we've done at Sandia, and I want to use them to illustrate the fact that not only do you have to consider the vertical resistance, but you have to also consider these other properties of the mirror stack. So here are these two designs that are shown here, an earlier one and then the later one that we did. And basically the whole notion here is that alloy content is a bad thing. It reduces thermal conductivity, it reduces electrical mobility, and large grated regions reduce optical reflectivity. So let's get rid of as much alloy content as we can and only concentrate the alloy content where we need it. If you look at this top curve, you can see that discontinuities in the slope cause potential cusps to form. And one sign of discontinuity forms upward pointing cusps, and the other type of discontinuity forms these potential troughs. Well, it's really just the barriers up here that limit the carrier transport. Carriers tend to puddle in these troughs, but that's not a major limitation to vertical transport through the structure. So let's concentrate grating out this high band gap region to make it smooth as we've done down here, but not worry about these discontinuities at the low end. In fact, by including these discontinuities, we can create potential troughs that collect carriers, and these, in fact, will be useful for conductivity out of the plane, or in the plane of the layers itself. Now, in doing this, you can look at these various properties over here, and you can see that the vertical resistance of the structure has actually been reduced in doing this, largely as a result of trying to use pure gallium arsenide as opposed to 10%, as well as carbon doping and some things associated with the growth method. However, we've also reduced the sheet resistance, that is the resistance in this direction of the structure, by about 30%. We've also increased the optical reflectivity, and we've increased the thermal conductivity both in the direction parallel and perpendicular. And so we've improved not only the vertical resistance of the structure, but all the properties. In particular, I want to point out why the sheet resistance is so important in these types of structures. If we now go ahead and make laser diodes based on these two types of mirror grating designs, and we plot the resistance not just of part of the mirror, but of the whole device on a log-log plot as a function of the size of the device, we can look at what type of power law trend the resistance takes. And you can see that both of the experimental curves lie reasonably close to this 1 over radius type dependence, much closer to it than, say, a 1 over radius squared. If you now think about where these things originate in this structure, you can see that certain parts of the conduction mechanism are actually dominating. The thing that most everybody worried about early on, the conduction vertically through the mirrors, is a constriction, the area of which scales is 1 over the radius squared, shown here color-coded in cyan. However, there's also resistance due to contact resistance that scales as 1 over the perimeter, and this lateral spreading resistance, as well as the spreading out of a uniform potential disk into a three-dimensional half space, all of which scale as 1 over the radius. And because our data lies much closer to the 1 over radius, we infer that it's actually these cyan-colored processes that dominate as opposed to the magenta-colored one. And so we really want to concentrate on the lateral resistance in the structure to help out with that. In fact, in our final devices, we actually did things like introduce latent layers of heavily doped gallium arsenide that had no optical purpose, but in fact they reduced the lateral resistance. At any rate, it was using techniques such as that that we were able to make more efficient VCSELs. In fact, this shows a result for a device that's relatively large, 30 microns in diameter, fabricated with proton implantation, and it had a 21% power conversion efficiency. So if you multiply 30 milliamps times about 1.9 volts it's dropping, and compare that ratio to the 12 milliwatts you're getting out, you get about this 21% power conversion efficiency. And this was the most power conversion efficient VCSEL that had been made at that time. However, there's still some problems from a practical standpoint here, and this high power conversion efficiency is happening at a relatively high power output of 12 milliwatts. So unless you have a unique application, say you make really bad detectors and you need a lot of optical power in your communication system for it, then you really don't need that level of power. Most VCSEL applications need much less, on the order of a milliwatt or so. And if we think about operating this device down at a milliwatt, you can see that the contribution from threshold is a major limiting factor in order to make the device more efficient. And so it's not terribly efficient at 1 milliwatt. You say, well, that's a simple problem. Just make the device smaller, okay? Let me show you what happens when we make the device smaller. This is a very similar wafer, about an 8-micron diameter device. And as an aside, when you make the devices smaller, you do get them to operate in a single transverse mode in addition to the natural single longitudinal mode. In fact, this shows that we obtained up to something like 4.5 milliwatts of single mode power before this transverse mode came up above about 35 dB or so of the main mode. That is, there was a mode suppression ratio of almost 40 dB through this range. Now, I've tried to obscure the problem with this laser as much as possible by actually choosing the non-zero axis for the origin for the horizontal axis. The problem is the device still has a 7 milliamp threshold, just like the 30 micron one did. In fact, if we put up a plot that quantifies this trend, we can see that there's a lower limit on the threshold current. I also have to make an aside here and apologize for this graph. My printer decided to drop the mu's off some of the units in this figure, so be sure and read this in microns, not meters. We're interested in high power lasers at Sandia, but that's not the approach we're taking. So, as we scale the device down to, say, about 15 microns in diameter, the threshold current decreases linearly in the size as opposed to as the square of it that you might expect. And then it kind of reaches a minimum and turns back up. We can gain some insight into the mechanism by looking at this inset here that shows a 20 micron diameter device and a 10 micron diameter device. 20 micron diameter device has a threshold current down here something like 3.5 milliamps. And it's relatively linear. But the 10 micron diameter device has a much higher threshold current, and it has this anomalous shape where it kind of holds off for a while and then snaps on all of a sudden as we're ramping up the current. Now, if you take this device and you modulate it with an AC signal about a bias point like this, you can get it to trace out an IV curve that lies over here and intercepts somewhere down around here around 2 milliamps or less. In fact, if you take this device, you bias it here, and then you put a sudden pulse on it, you can bring it down and operate at a point here for about a microsecond before it snaps off. All of this is indicative that the device is thermally limited. Basically, going back to the proton implanted device, remember there's no built-in index, and the way the device really functions is by heating up in the middle, and to some extent to suck the mode away from the lossy region on the side, and confine the mode into a small diameter. Now, as we make smaller and smaller devices, we're not really scaling that thermally induced index guide along with the fact that we're scaling the gain region down. We get higher and higher losses. And then eventually we get to some point where we have to dissipate relatively high powers in the device in order to set up a strong enough thermal lens to pull the mode into the low loss region. And that's precisely what's going on here. In fact, you know, all this work about improving the efficiency with decreasing the power dissipation and improving the thermal conductivity, well, really, we haven't done ourselves any favors there, because if you think about it, that just goes against the notion of trying to form a stronger thermal lens. So in some ways, those improvements actually hurt us. Well, the obvious answer to this problem is to build in something that has an index contrast, that is, put in built-in index guiding. While we were facing that problem, some really great work came out of the University of Texas at Austin by Dennis Deppe's group. They were also working on VCSELs, but they didn't subscribe to the officially Sandia theory that all VCSELs should be made with semiconductor mirrors. They were trying to, they were actually quite successful in making them with these insulating dielectric pairs. But one of the things, one of the issues associated with their devices is that they had to then use a relatively thin gallium arsenide layer to conduct current laterally, and they didn't have a thick region for an implant. So they were looking at other techniques of using thin insulating layers. And they actually adopted a technique developed by Nick Holoniak's group at the University of Illinois, where they converted an aluminum arsenide layer to an aluminum oxide layer, a process I'll describe in a minute, that turns the material insulating, and it funnels current in. Now, using this technique, they were able to make lasers that had threshold currents of about 250 microamps in the very range where we had these threshold currents shooting up. And we were convinced that not only was electrically insulating property of this aluminum oxide important, but also the low index property of the oxide was important in defining an index guide that kept squeezing the mode down as you squeeze down the pump's diameter of the device. And so we got going quickly on the oxides, trying to leverage that in order to take advantage of this phenomenon. In fact, this is the structure made at Sandia National Labs here, and I'll describe in detail how we make it in a minute. This is an implanted structure shown for reference, where the PN junction is here at the junction of the two colors with the distributed Bragg reflector stacks. This is the University of Texas structure with this dielectric mirror deposited on it. Now, one of the problems we had is that we'd worked really hard on this conducting mirror and taking care of this lateral resistance of this thick layer. We weren't about to chuck it and just go to these thin conducting layers here because of resistance reasons. And so we had to find some way to maintain this conducting part of the mirror stack while only oxidizing in a thin layer at the bottom. And as I said, I'll tell you how that's done in a minute. First, let me just tell you that there's been other approaches as well. The Tokyo Institute of Technology, they've worked at oxidizing all the way up and down the mirror stack to form a distributed waveguide. Turns out this acts as a waveguide in a relatively interesting way. I probably won't have time to go into it today, but I can talk to you about it afterwards if you want to. And people have also now used these oxides for the mirror layers. Because of the large index contrast, they can also get away with using fewer mirror periods when they take this type of approach. So let me tell you how you oxidize in just a portion of the structure. It's actually some very nice work that Kent Choquette and Rich Schneider and others of us at Sandia were involved in, that used the oxidation of various mole fractions of aluminum gallium arsenide in order to change the oxidation rate. Imagine you take this super lattice up here and you grow in different layers. Say you grow a set of, say, three layers of 90% aluminum gallium arsenide with gallium arsenide barriers in between, and then you start growing 92% layers, 94, 96, 98, whatever, on up. And you etch away the side of this, you stick it in a furnace somewhere between 400 and 450 degrees with the steam environment, and you react it. What you'll find is that you oxidize these layers in, converting the algas to aluminum oxide, but the rate at which they oxidize in is a function of that aluminum mole fraction. And you can see by simply varying the aluminum mole fraction from about 98% to 88%, you can change the oxidation rate by almost an order of magnitude. And so the layers that we want to oxidize in a long ways, we make 98%, and the ones that we only want to oxidize a little bit, we just make them 92 or 94%. Let me just say a couple more words about this oxidation process. Again, it's a reaction of a hot steam with the aluminum arsenide, and it forms something that's very much like an alumina compound that you would use in packaging, the ceramic. It's Al2O3 gamma phase. It's relatively mechanically stable in and of itself, although there's some issues with adhesion to neighboring semiconductor. As I said, we can take doped conducting aluminum arsenide and turn it insulating with this process, and we can also alter the index of refraction from about 2.95 or 3.0 to 1.55 for the alumina. Unfortunately, this, although the process resembles a lot what you use in silicon wet oxidation, we don't end up with the same nice low density of states at the interface, and so we have a high surface recombination velocity. And again, you can control this reasonably well in a limited reaction regime as a function of temperature and alloy content. So here's a picture of one of these devices, and what we've going to do here is start off with the square mesa, and in this top view oxidize in, we end up with a aperture in the oxide that's congruent with the initial starting mesa shape in this case. And you can see that the mesa down here in this photo is right here. We've oxidized it in. We're driving current through this probe tip to light up this portion of the laser diode right here. Now let me show you a scanning electron micrograph of the cross section of this device with these pinching layers coming in. There's a little bit of aliasing between the video digitization and the mirror stack here, but I think you can still make out these darker aluminum oxide layers coming in from each side, and there's contacts not well shown up here with the current being pinched into this middle active region that's about 10 microns in diameter. We actually have some freedom to tailor what these things look like. If you look at the scanning electron micrograph down here, this slight zoom up, you can see that in this case, we've just oxidized in one layer that's 98%, and maybe the rest of these mirror stack layers are 92% or something like that. If we actually want to oxidize in more layers, say a couple of them, we'll make two of them 98% on each side, then maybe we'll say, well, let's make these 96%, and they oxidize in, and 92% or whatever. You can design the amount of oxidation, this oxidation profile, in order to control this process. So the net outcome of this process is that when we applied this technique as well as our low resistance mirror technology, we ended up with devices that had up to 50% power conversion efficiency. In order to get that in this particular device, we had to have at the same time low threshold currents, say 350 microamps, high slope efficiencies, here a differential quantum efficiency of 80%, and relatively low operating voltages, say under 2 volts through this whole regime for this 980 nanometer device. All of that combined gave us 50% power conversion efficiency, and it gave it to us where we wanted it. That is, at the 1 milliwatt level that was more appropriate for applications. So basically, if you want a milliwatt of output optical power out of this VCSEL, you have to stick 2 milliwatts of electrical power in, and you only dissipate 1 milliwatt of power inside the device. And that's attractive as we try to move to denser arrays and so forth. Now, there's been continuing work in this field. And more recently, there's been some work at the University of Ulm in Germany in Professor Carl Ebeling's group, and they've been able to make devices now that are up to 57% power conversion efficient. In fact, these are at 850 nanometers with gallium arsenide quantum wells, and they reach this power conversion efficiency up here somewhere around 2 or 3 milliwatts. There's a whole lot of other benefits to doing this oxide technology, and one of them is that we get rid of the squirrely characteristics we had for our devices in the first place. These red curves are implanted devices with various diameters shown in microns. Same wafer, if we fabricate it using the selective oxidation, you can see that we make devices that have nice linear characteristics, and we can change the size over the full range of these and maintain linear characteristics throughout that whole range. Now, if we look at how the threshold current scales in this case, remember this anomalous upturn in threshold current for the implanted devices. Using the oxide, we continue to come down along a line of constant threshold current density, and then depending on exactly how we design things, things tend to saturate down here in the submilliamp regime someplace. Sometimes they turn back up a little bit down here, or other folks have been able to make them go down to even lower levels. In fact, here's one of the more recent results to come out of Dennis Deppe's group at the University of Texas at Austin. They've been able to make devices that have threshold currents at a mind-bogglingly low number of 40 microamperes. And so the threshold current in these devices are really impressive. They've changed by more than an order of magnitude over the past couple of years over what the previous best laser diodes were. One of the possibilities for getting even lower threshold currents in the future is to taper this oxide boundary where it comes in because it's a source of diffraction loss. This shows some work that we've done where we've changed the aluminum composition here in order to not end the oxide abruptly, but to have it taper off. And so if you think about this low index region embedded in the high index region, this is actually acting as a focusing lens. And you can see that this is in the middle of the cavity with the distributed Bragg reflectors top and bottom. So now we're starting to be able to put these optics inside this plane cavity geometry. In fact, we've also made lenses just by themselves. This is work that's in collaboration with Olga Blum, where again we varied the aluminum composition so that we can oxidize in different distances. We leave this lens shaped in this high index 3.0 aluminum gallium arsenide layer, and in fact experimentally we've shown that we can focus collimated light beams down into a spot using this type of lens. Another interesting attribute of this work on oxidized devices is that it's allowed us to see squeezing in microcavity lasers for the first time. This is work that's done in collaboration with Dan Kilper at Montana State University. And basically, if you shine a white light onto a detector and look at the shot noise limit of that device, you get something up here that's correlated with the square root of the number of photons. However, if you shine a laser on the detector, one of these lasers on the detector that's operating in a high efficiency regime, you can actually get less noise here up to about 1.3 dB below the shot noise limit. I should say the shape here is related to the amplifier response. So that we can actually reduce the noise coming out of these lasers, and Dan and his colleagues will be talking about this at Clio and Quells next week. Basically, why this is germane to the high efficiency laser is because we have to extract the photons in order to preserve squeezing. What happens is the electrons tend to repel each other with Coulomb repulsion so that they space themselves out more evenly than you would normally expect and thus reduce the shot noise limit in the current flow. As those electrons move into the laser, they get converted into photons, and the imprint of the sub-shot noise on the electrons gets transferred to the distribution of photons. However, if you start losing too many of these photons and just leaving the other ones randomly spaced, it appears to have more of a stochastic noise process again. So we have to preserve the photons through the system in order to observe the squeezing. Okay, the final area I want to talk about that has also come out of this laser development is high-speed devices. This shows a cross-section of, again, one of these oxide-confined VCSELs. And it turns out that several of the things we've done have allowed us to make high-speed lasers as well. Intrinsically, what we need for high-speed lasers is a high photon density. And because we have this oxide confinement, we're able to squeeze the light into a small space in order to get a high photon density. And then we can also run the devices at many times threshold in order to boost up the photon density. Extrinsically, we have this low-resistance mirror to reduce the RC charging time for the device. And we also are using, in this particular case, a polyimide planarization to decrease the capacitance of this pad so that in this particular geometry out here, this pad has about a 50 femtofarad capacitance. And we're fabricating these in a ground signal ground configuration so we can come in with a coaxial waveguide probe, a coax to waveguide probe, and probe this structure on wafer for characterization. Now, it turns out that dealing with the extrinsic parasitics in that way wasn't quite enough. We actually had to do a couple more tricks. We'd reduced this capacitor, where we've superimposed now an equivalent circuit on this device schematic. We reduced this capacitor, as I said, to 50 femtofarads. But it turns out that this thin oxide in here makes a really great capacitor in and of itself. We have a material that has an epsilon relative of about 8, and it's thin on the order of 50 nanometers or so. And so we have a high capacitance, something like 200 or 300 femtofarads associated with it in the mesa. To keep it from shorting out the device at high frequencies, we had to come back with implantation and make a hybrid device to kill off this outlying mesa area here and reduce the capacitance of that. One other thing we did is we actually flipped the polarity. Normally you grow the N-type mirror on the bottom and P-type on the top, but here we've inverted it so to improve the lateral conductivity of this top mirror. Another thing that you need to be able to do in order to make very high-speed devices is to make them run single mode. And I see that I grabbed the wrong view graph. This has an uncorrected error. I wish we had devices that operated at 147 gigahertz, but this should actually be wavelength in nanometers here. The point of this graph is that even at 10 times the threshold current of half a milliamp, we have devices that have a mode suppression ratio approaching, again, 40 dB. And so almost all the photons we're generating are going into that fundamental mode as opposed to being dispersed to other ones. When you do those kind of things, you can end up with modulation characteristics like this that show relatively large bandwidths for these 850 nanometer lasers. When we run this somewhere at 10 or 11 times threshold, we see that we have 3 dB bandwidths that are getting out here to something like 21.5 gigahertz. And I should comment that we believe that that's the fastest laser diodes that have ever been made at 850 nanometers. And that may sound to you kind of like, well, we made the fastest green wagon that's ever been made, although there are red wagons that are faster. The reason it's germane is because at 850, we have gallium arsenide quantum wells that are unstrained. We don't have indium in them. If you put indium in them and strain them, you get higher differential gain, and you can make the laser resonance frequency move out faster. And it's also practically appropriate because of the fact of some of the standards and so forth for communication at 850 nanometers and the benefits there versus longer wavelengths. At any rate, we have these relatively large bandwidths, and also at low bias currents, we get very useful bandwidths of 10 gigahertz. So we can make devices that operate at low frequencies, at low bias currents, still at high frequency. Now let me show you a little larger device. That was a 4x4 micron. When we make 8x8 micron devices, they run multimode, and we still get bandwidths that go out here in excess of 15 gigahertz, although we have to use higher currents in order to maintain the same threshold current density. We can take this type of device now and use it in communications experiments. And here's one result of such an experiment. This shows that multimode 8x8 micron laser being modulated at 6 gigabits per second. And I should say there's an inverting amplifier in this device. So if you want to think about the laser, this is what it's doing. When we turn it on strongly, there's some ringing. So there's no type of Thompson-Bessel filtering in this particular thing. But you can see we get nice wide open eyes at 6 gigabits per second. In fact, we've modulated this at twice the speed, so you'd imagine another crossing in the middle of this here, and we still have open eyes, and run it at 12 gigabits per second, which is the limit of our test, been able to show that can get low bit error rates of 10 to the minus 13 and just kind of quick setups looking at that. Now, unfortunately, we're not able to get those types of bit error rates at all operating conditions, and let me explain. The plot I've just shown you was biased at this filled square point here. And if you construct the ECL modulation onto this device with 50 ohm load lines, you can see it's kind of going back and forth between these points here. And notably, this point is at a current where it's above threshold, so we're modulating it strictly above threshold. However, if we reduce the bias current down to the circle point and we modulate it, we now are intercepting at a point below threshold down here, so we're trying to turn the laser on from below threshold. And when we do it, we end up with just a bit of pattern-dependent jitter. In fact, you can see the eye is actually closed in, making the device not useful anymore at 6 gigabits per second. We measure delays ranging from 50 picoseconds to 150 picoseconds or so. And by changing the size of the device a little bit and going back to single mode ones, we've been able to decrease the sum. Even for this multi-mode device, this amount of jitter is probably still tolerable in some schemes for modulation about a gigabit per second. And we believe in some of the smaller devices, we can operate from below threshold at speeds up to about 2.5 gigabits per second. Okay, let me just finish up now by talking about some of the applications. Obviously, the big application for these devices and the one that's really happening right now is in the area of communications. In particular, we can make these devices with arrays and use multi-channel communications to increase our aggregate bandwidth. And particularly what's a commercial reality now is in fiber optics, although obviously you can think about packing even more channels into free space configurations. The other thing about these VCSELs is that they're a relatively economic way of getting single mode sources. And so there's certain diffraction limited applications that come to mind, such as ones in scanning or in printing, where you're requiring relatively modest laser diode powers for smaller print speeds. Also, because we have a single line, we can think about doing some types of sensing operations, such as chemical absorption, where we're modulating the laser line on and off a chemical absorption line in order to try to measure the concentration of certain species. Or you can think about doing things such as the laser equivalent to chirped Doppler radar, where I should say just chirped radar, where you're bouncing the signal off of something and mixing it, coming back in a heterodyne fashion to give you machine vision for ranging over the coherence length, which is on the order of a couple of meters. Of course, optical computing springs as an eternal hope in our heart, although I guess we rename it as optical processing, depending on what our funding sponsors tell us they want to hear. And at any rate, VCSELs obviously have some applications to smart pixels and use in those types of areas. There have actually been funded consortia on using VCSELs in displays, imagine 1,000 by 1,000 elements, although I think that the power dissipation is still way too high to make those kind of things a practical reality, as well as the challenges of making VCSELs in the visible wavelength. Let me just quickly show you in the first area there some products that are out to convince you that VCSELs are real and will eventually affect your life. This is one of the first VCSEL-based products that came out of Motorola. It's called OptoBus, and it uses an array of VCSELs and an array of detectors over here to send data now, I guess they're speccing 400 megabits per second across a 10-bit wide channel. Turns out that this 400 megabits per second is a limit of the driver circuitry, the CMOS inside here, more than a limit of the lasers themselves. Nonetheless, that combined gives an aggregate data rate of 4 gigabits per second. Now, while this type of array thing is exciting in terms of the application of VCSELs, it actually seems that there's probably a stronger interest initially in just doing single channels. Here's an example of a single channel HP module operating at 1.5 gigabits per second, compatible with a variety of transmission formats. And what I think companies like HP and Honeywell are beginning to think of VCSELs as is a fast replacement for LEDs, and so they're using them in the type of lengths that would formerly have had LEDs used in them. Honeywell also is working on this type of transmit-receive module, and Honeywell is one of the few companies that will sell you a VCSEL by itself in a can, such as these shown here. And so these devices are becoming a reality commercially. Let me just finish up quickly and tell you about one other type of device, one other type of VCSEL that has applications. Sandia has been working on red VCSELs for some time. And these, this wavelength in particular is attractive for things such as printing, because a lot of photoreceptors are much more responsive at wavelengths of, say, 670 or 650 nanometers than they are in the IR. Also, by making 650 nanometer VCSELs, we can match them to the attenuation minimum in PMMA fiber and get longer transmission distances. Although I want to emphasize the dominant application to date for red VCSELs is to make displays of the company logo to impress company vice presidents. Here's kind of where red VCSELs stand right now at Sandia. They've reasonably good powers out of them, including single mode powers up to 2 milliwatts. It's really hard to push these things down below much shorter than kind of in the 640 nanometer range. And also they're more limited in terms of the operating temperature than some of the other devices. But you can see again by applying selective oxidation, devices that have been, that are more efficient are coming along, as well as devices that have lower threshold currents. So let me stop there and just summarize by saying that over the past 5 years, VCSEL performance has been improving rapidly, and these types of numbers are benchmark testimony to that, that multiple folks have reported devices that are 50% or more efficient. There's also been reports of really amazingly low thresholds, in some cases maybe too amazingly low. This result has been repeated. I'm not sure that one has. And also I've shown you that the operating speeds of the devices can be quite large, especially for 850 nanometer devices. To get to that level of performance, you really have to think about multiple aspects of the problem, including the electrical issues. And we've seen that things like DBR grading and design, as well as things we really haven't talked about as much, such as growth techniques and fabrication techniques, can give you low electrical resistance in the devices. Optical confinement has really been helped by using oxides in the devices, And we're now able to make strongly index-guided devices using that technique. However, we still have more work to do. Even though we can funnel the current into a small place and get it there with relatively low resistance, and even though we can confine the light into a small place, we can't necessarily keep the carriers in a small place yet. The carriers tend to diffuse outward from the active region in these quantum wells that extend off to effectively infinity. And what we really need to do is come up with some way to confine carriers. The standard ways to do this in normal edge emitters are with regrowth or with impurity-induced disordering. And I have a hunch that those are the way that VCSELs are going to be eventually made as well, as soon as we get smart enough to know how to make those techniques work for the complicated epitaxial structure. VCSELs are being commercialized, as I've pointed out. There's been multiple announcements of these types of links. Honeywell is selling samples, certainly, in packages and packaged components. So what are the remaining challenges for VCSELs? Well, just a couple of them. One is better transverse mode control. We'd really like to be able to get 10 or 20 milliwatts of single mode power in these devices so that we can use them in optical memory systems like magneto-optical drives. And obviously, in terms of the material system development, we need to be able to make useful devices at long wavelengths, which for the case of VCSELs means even making them at 1.3 and 1.55 microns. And also, as gallium nitride and other materials come along, we want to take advantage of those for VCSELs. In particular, in terms of gallium nitride, there are some issues associated with facet formation with the mirrors, with etching, because of the difficulty of cleaving on sapphire. And in the VCSEL, everything's stood on its head, so we're growing the mirrors in. And if you can get around the current transport problems associated with the P-type DBR, VCSELs may be an attractive way to make gallium nitride lasers. With that, I'll stop, and thank you for listening to my story, and see if you have any questions I can answer for you.